That's a go. All right, this is Kids Camp 2011. This is class number 4. Our speaker is our brother Ken Stiles. The topic for this year is Elijah, and this class is entitled The Power of the Still Small Voice.
Thank you, Brother Dan, and good morning, everyone. By the looks of things, we shouldn't have any trouble relating to the lessons from today's story, because there's a lot of us that look like we've been wandering in the wilderness for the last 40 days and nights. Okay, we wanted to start this morning taking a look at what I'm suggesting is a rough chronology of these 22 years of Ahab's life. There's a part we don't know, and that is how soon within the beginning of Ahab's reign did he undertake all the apostasy of the last few verses of chapter 16. We are assuming that it all happened within the first 5 years. It could have all happened in the first 2 years. We just don't know. So for purposes of illustration, we've had all of the apostasy and the marriage to Jezebel in the first 5 years. We do know there's a 3.5 year period of the famine. And then there's a big piece of Ahab's reign that we don't know what happened, at least from a time frame standpoint. Year 18, we know, because it says in chapter 20 that there was a year of war with Syria. That's when he had the two wars 6 months apart. Naboth's vineyard likely happens after that because it's recorded in chapter 21. And then we also know the last 3 years of Ahab's life, because at the beginning of chapter 22, it says there was 3 years of peace with Syria before Ahab got this idea that he should join forces with Jehoshaphat and then go to war with Syria, which will eventually cost Ahab his life. So we can nail down pretty much the last three or four years of Ahab's life. Sorry. My mistake. My apologies, Brother Chuck. There's a few people around here you don't want to get on the wrong side of. That's all I'll say. with loving kindness in my comments. No, he's been very good and very hospitable towards us, and we very much appreciate his love. So we know the end of Ahab's life, and we know what happened at the beginning of Ahab's life, but we're not just sure where everything fits in. If the famine begins in year 5, and again, it could have begun in year 2, then Mount Carmel and Mount Horeb occur around 8.5 years into his reign. We do know that Mount Carmel happens and Mount Horeb happens within 45 days of each other, because you can track through how long it took Elijah to leave Jezreel, how long it took him to get to Beersheba, how long it took him to get to Horeb. But then there is this big gap in which the events simply aren't recorded. But that big gap between year 8.5 on our chart and year 18 is when Elijah would have done his public ministry. You see, he couldn't preach during the 3.5 years of the famine, partly because the first year he was hidden at the brook Cherith and it wasn't safe for him to go around Israel. And he couldn't preach when he was up in Sidon, up in Zarephath, living with the widow. So his public ministry doesn't really begin until after Mount Carmel. Chapter 19 in his trip to Mount Horeb is all about Elijah's weaknesses. So it's helpful that we know going into the chapter, remind ourselves what his strengths were. And he is a strong believer in Yahweh. He is a faithful believer in Yahweh. But as wonderful as his life was, it's very appropriate that this incident surrounding Mount Horeb is recorded for our benefit, because Elijah will learn a lesson at Mount Horeb that will change his life. And if you'll notice on the chart, it comes at a very opportune time. because he's just about to begin his public ministry. And the lesson he learns at Horeb will prepare him for that public ministry. We know going to Horeb, Elijah already has a zeal for God. He is jealous for God, serving him alone. He deeply loves his God, evidenced by his obedience and faithful service. He has spiritual courage, demonstrated at Carmel, demonstrated in going into Ahab's court in chapter 17 at verse 1, when he decreed that there would be no rain. James calls him a righteous man in James 5 verse 16 before Mount Horeb. And James also states what we've already seen, that his prayers are both powerful in how they are offered and powerful in their effect. We've also seen that Elijah is teachable. The ravens were able to teach him. The widow of Zarephath was able to teach him. So we want to have these things clear in our mind before we embark in today's study. If you reflect upon the impact of the events on Mount Carmel on Elijah, the immediate impact would have been tremendously encouraging. Hearing the people's response, Yahweh is the God, seeing Ahab's response, running down the mountain in front of his chariot, seeing the 450 prophets all slain. Ahab seems to have a newfound faith as he's going down the mountain. The nation appears to be healed and are returning to Yahweh. The effects of Carmel on Ahab seem to be positive as well. He enjoys the meal of fellowship. He's glad to see the rain return. He's been impressed by the miracle. He's seen the futility of the prophets of Baal. On Jezebel, it's a different story. The effects of Carmel on her only intensifies her hatred of Yahweh, intensifies her hatred of Elijah, and as we know, she issues a death sentence against him. She was unfazed by Carmel. And in the record, as we have seen, she has been unfazed by everything God does in these events. 450 prophets have been slain, and she is seething. And she holds Elijah personally responsible for the events of Mount Carmel. Her dominating influence over Ahab is once again revealed. He's at a critical stage in his life. There will only be one Mount Carmel in Ahab's life. And God has been leading Ahab up to this point for 3.5 years. And he's going to focus now all of his attention and all of his efforts on reaching the heart of Ahab and changing his heart, as we saw yesterday. He did not slay Ahab on Mount Carmel because God was still trying to win Ahab back to righteousness. And all of the good that is unleashed in Carmel and all of the momentum to return to Yahweh and to change his life, it's all there. And Jezebel is able to undo it in a single conversation. Ahab woke up the morning of Mount Carmel and he was in whose camp? Baal's. By the time he comes down the mountain that day, he's in whose camp? Yahweh's. By the time he goes to sleep that night, he's in whose camp? Baal's. Hopping between two opinions in a single day. God is teaching us that if we allow the influence of Jezebel into our life, and it's going to be different for you than me. So when I say Jezebel, just don't think of a harlot woman. Think of the idols of today, as we talked about on Monday. Those influences that I allow into my life to incite my lusts, that then cause me to act in a way that is ungodly, whatever that is. If we're allowing that into our life, it can change us from Carmel to going to bed that night in a single day. That's how powerful the influence of sin is in our life. We can come home from this week, God willing, and we can see it all undone. If we have sat here and studied with the kids and played with the kids and read the Bible with the kids and encouraged them to take idols out of their life, and not allow the influence of sin to dominate them, and to see the benefits and the wonders and the blessings, that God promises to those who do these things, if we then go home and all of that is allowed to rush back into our life for whatever reason, all the good from this week will be gone by Sunday night if we're not careful. That's the warning and the lesson of chapter 19 and the influence that Jezebel had on Ahab. We might ask, why didn't God simply remove Jezebel from Israel? And we know the reason. God will not remove Jezebel's influence from our life, just like he won't remove sin's influence from our life. He preserves our free will. He provides two paths, and he says, Jezebel, idolatry, sin, is not a power that I'm going to shield you from and protect you from. It's a power in your life that the faithful have to learn to overcome by bringing to bear in their life a power that is greater than the power of sin. That's how God develops the gems. He allows them to come under the influence of sin, as we know, and doesn't protect them from it. Yes, we should pray that God will deliver us from evil. But we're talking now in terms of the nature that we bear. We're talking about the evil influences that we see in the world. They will only get worse. Because God doesn't protect us from those. He doesn't shield us from those. He says, instead, what I'm going to do is give you a power in your life that is greater than those. So that each person must decide for themselves to both minimize and remove the influence of sin and also to learn to trust him and be fully committed to the transformation process that God is seeking to accomplish. For the 7,000, Jezebel had no power to destroy them spiritually because they had determined in their mind that they would not become one of her followers. You know, Jezebel's power is so overwhelming and destructive that we see in this chapter that it even reaches into the life of Elijah. It shows how dominant and fearful a person she was. If you've never known a woman like this, it's almost hard to imagine. But there are women today that can exercise this kind of fearful power and destructive influence. And that was the kind of woman that Jezebel had, or the kind of woman that she was. Sinister in all of her activities. Her message to Elijah, that you will be dead within 24 hours, had a crushing effect upon Elijah. A crushing effect, mentally and physically and emotionally and spiritually and psychologically. He's an absolute wreck as a result of that message. That's how powerful her warning was. It's now evident to him that Ahab has not been converted. Everything that happened at Carmel was all superficial. He's had no change of heart. All the good that Carmel was intended to accomplish has been undone. The sky-high expectations Elijah had coming down the mountain, running faster than any man has ever run and probably ever will run till the kingdom comes, that those sky-high expectations are all destroyed when he gets the message that if he doesn't flee, his life will be dead. Such was the power of Jezebel in his life. You know, I really don't think she was interested in killing him. She thinks these things through. A dead Elijah is of little value. But a discredited Elijah, now that has great power. She could have easily told the messengers, you're not really messengers, you're assassins, and sought to take his life. She is much more advantaged by Elijah fleeing his people and fleeing his God and fleeing his responsibilities. And you notice she couched it all in a contest of gods. My God's due to me and more also if you're not dead by tomorrow this time. So it's going to be my gods against your God. And we'll see who wins. And Elijah flees. So who's God's win? And she's got her gods right back up in the face of the nation as being the supreme deities. And where is Elijah? He's on his way out of town. She knew exactly what she was doing. She wants him to flee. She's reclaiming the supremacy of her gods over Yahweh. And Elijah succumbs to her threat and believes she can kill him. And in the end, Baal will be victorious. And at that point in Elijah's life, the fireball of Jezebel is more powerful than the fireball he saw come out of heaven on Mount Carmel. Because he's now responding to her warning instead of responding to what he had seen the day before. So within 24 hours, it wasn't just Ahab that was overcome by her influence and had a change of heart. It was Elijah. He stood on Carmel and challenged the nation to change their allegiance. He stood on Carmel and declared that the prophet should be destroyed. He stood on Carmel and prayed for the salvation of his people. And within 24 hours, it's all gone, all lost. But he will learn a lesson at Horeb that will allow him to be recovered, unlike Ahab. You see, Jezebel had drained Elijah of his faith and of his hope and of his love. And that's what sin does, brethren and sisters, as we all know. We allow ourselves to come under its influence, and we believe no longer that God can save us from it. And it will drain our faith and hope and love. And it will drain our desire to save his people and our commitment to serve him. Now, we need to be careful when we go through this chapter. If you hear me criticizing Elijah, then I have misspoken. And the reason I say that is nowhere in chapter 19 does God criticize Elijah. He will rebuke him and he will admonish him. But God never comes to Elijah and says, look, you shouldn't have come here. Go back. And the proof of that is when he gets to Beersheba. He is at the lowest point of his life, no doubt about it. And what does God do for this man who has been a faithful servant of his when he has reached the lowest point of his life? He's in great despair when he leaves Jezreel. He is despondent. He is in deep depression. And it's a great chapter, as we all know, to encourage those who find themselves in depression. He has multiple reasons for his despondency. And we always do. We always have multiple reasons why we are in despair when we are. Or why we are despondent. There almost always is. He could have made a long list, including the fact that even he himself fears Jezebel. But watch how God works with him. He won't criticize Elijah for being weak and faithless and ignorant, even though he is. And remember that when we're working with others who have been overwhelmed by Jezebel's power momentarily in their life. It's not a time for criticism. It's a time to reflect and to manifest the principles that we see God showing forth to Elijah in this chapter. He speaks his despair. You can hear it in his words. It is enough, he says. In other words, I am finished. I have done all that I can. There is nothing more for me to do. His hope to convert the nation was lost. It's now evident that the nation is not going to be converted. Jezebel is just too strong. Ahab couldn't last a single night. And it's all undone. Take my life away, he says, which is a reflection of his deep depression. I don't want to live any longer. My reason for living is gone. And I am no better than my fathers. He was acknowledging he was a failure, that his life's work was a failure. He's concluded there's no hope. There's no future. There's no more work left for me to do. when he arrives at Beersheba. This is his mental outlook, and it's a mental outlook, and it's the words reflective of a brother who is broken and discouraged. He craves sleep, which, if you have any experience with depression, is typical of those who are depressed. So the angel wakes him twice. Marvelous to see how Elijah is in this condition, and God, in his wisdom and in his gentleness and his mercy, sends an angel to strengthen him and to comfort him. Not to separate from him, not to criticize him. It's one of the wonders of the character of the God that we worship. He will need strength to go 40 days and nights. In fact, put yourself there in the situation. God is actually going to work a miracle to allow Elijah to be strengthened so he can get to Horeb for the very purpose of arguing against God and his people. Because God knows Elijah needs to learn the lesson at Horeb. So he will miraculously strengthen and encourage him and sustain him for that 40-day period, just so that Elijah can get to Horeb, just so he can make his case against Israel. That's why we say there's great love and gentleness in how God is orchestrating these events. He didn't say, well, if you can get to Horeb, I'll listen to you. Elijah couldn't have gotten to Horeb, likely without God's involvement. And if he could have, it's not material, because God intervenes early on and says, I'm going to help you get to Horeb. Elijah had placed himself with the fathers. And because he has to walk much of the same territory as Israel did during their 40 years in the wilderness, what God is showing him is you're much more like the children of Israel, not like the fathers, in this journey to Horeb. But God doesn't condemn him. He feeds him. Elijah is distraught, and God knows it. Now, verses 2 to 4, is another case where it provides a helpful New Testament exposition as to what's going on. In chapter 11 of Romans, we know it's Paul's chapter that is establishing that there will always be a remnant that God will work with and that God will provide, that his people will never, ever be permanently cut off. And he uses this low point in Israel's history when Ahab and Jezebel are on the throne and Jezebel has got supreme power in the land. He picks this extreme example in Israel's history to show those to whom he's writing the letter to the Romans that even in this extreme, awful situation, even when God's prophet was praying against the people, God was still preserving a remnant. God hath not cast away, Paul writes, his people which he foreknew. Wot ye not what the scripture saith of Elias, how he maketh intercession, or he prays to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets, and dig down thine altars, and I am alone left, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And you can see Elijah's thinking when he arrives at Horeb. The people are hopelessly astray. It won't be possible to recover them. And he condemns them and prays that God would destroy his own people. So he's gone from deep personal despair at Beersheba, and when he arrives at Horeb, he now ends up on the wrong side of God's will. And he is now praying for God's people to be destroyed. As Brother John Martin suggests, and I think it's a good suggestion, he likely picked Horeb because in Elijah's mind, Horeb is where God's thunder and warning was first announced to Israel. If you do not, at Sinai, if you do not follow me, these are the judgments that I will bring. And he goes back to that place and he says, God, it's time for the judgments to come. And Elijah arrives at Horeb And he still has his zeal, make no mistake about it. But he is on the wrong side of God's will. He has a wrong understanding. And up until now, every time we have seen Elijah pray, he has prayed and his will has lined up exactly with God's will. Whether it was the sun that needed to be raised, whether it was the famine that needed to come and the rain to be stopped, or the rain to be brought back, or the fireball to come from heaven, whatever it was, Elijah's will has always lined up directly with God's will. And God has answered his prayer. This time, Elijah's will and God's will are going in two different directions. And God will not answer this prayer of Elijah, which he interceded on behalf or against the people. He's now out of step with God. Elijah also at Horeb violates a fundamental principle of spiritual shepherding. Spiritual shepherds, whether they be fathers and mothers, CYC counselors, kids camp coordinators, arranging brethren, ecclesial shepherds, spiritual shepherds, never condemn the flock. Never. That is always left to God. We may condemn false teachers and false teachings, as we rightly should, and protect the flock from those bad influences. But shepherds should never, ever condemn the flock. Remember what Samuel said in 1 Samuel 12, when he cited the words, "Far be it from me that I should sin against Yahweh and cease to pray for you." Spiritual leaders always stand with the flock to save the flock, regardless of their sins. They never give up on the flock. So Daniel stayed with the flock. Nehemiah stayed with the flock. Ezra stayed with the flock. The Lord Jesus Christ stayed with the flock. There is a time for condemnation, but that's left in the hands of God. Now, I'm not saying we're talking here about we should never disfellowship people. That's not it at all. Understand the conditions at Horeb. You have a spiritual leader who is praying that God will destroy the nation. That should never happen in the life of a spiritual leader. Shepherds today must never give up on the flock, whether it's our ecclesia or our family. Our responsibility is to continue to try and reach and support and encourage and comfort them in their walk. Spiritual leaders need to avoid becoming discouraged, as Elijah had become discouraged at Carmel. And what God tells Elijah is there is a remnant out there. And we have to remember that, brethren and sisters. There is a remnant in our community today, and we know there will be a remnant in our community until the day the Lord Jesus Christ returns. We know that because of 1 Thessalonians 4 and the other verses surrounding those who are alive at the time of Christ's return. So there is a remnant among the young people that are here with us this week. And there is a remnant among our ecclesias, and there always will be. And we must never lose sight of the fact. That was what Paul was saying in Romans 11. There is always a remnant. If we lose sight of the remnant, we can end up where Elijah was. So God's response to Elijah's request that he destroy the nation is to tell Elijah about the 7,000. What will happen to them, Elijah, if I wipe out the nation? You don't even know they're there. You've come to Horeb to pray to me to destroy them. You don't even know they exist. You see, he was only, as we've seen earlier this week, he was only seeking others who looked like him and sounded like him. And if we're not careful and we introduce additional criteria to what a person needs to have that God doesn't introduce, we can begin to exclude people that should not be excluded. And we say this because 7,000 was a small multitude, 7,000 people. And Elijah didn't know they're out there because he couldn't see them. They're there, but he doesn't know it. He had disregarded what Obadiah had told him. It didn't square with his understanding of the remnant. You see, Elijah saw Carmel as a failure. Imagine the impact of Mount Carmel on the 7,000. It was a great day. God reestablishing himself as Yahweh, as the God of Israel. It didn't matter if the hearts of the people were fickle and Jezebel had her powerful influence. The 7,000 had learned to live by faith under the influence of Jezebel without bowing the knee to Baal and without kissing him. So they would have been invigorated by Carmel. They wouldn't have been fleeing. And that's why when Elijah comes to Carmel, or he comes to Mount Horeb, he's going to have to change his thinking. When he arrived at Horeb, his focus was on destroying the nation because it was wicked. And when he leaves Horeb, his focus will have changed to helping save the remnant. And that is the great life altering lesson that Elijah learns at Mount Horeb. He arrives with one mind frame, and because of the rebuke he receives by God in a very gentle way, he will leave Mount Horeb with a different understanding. You see, he needs to change his thinking. Before we leave this slide, the focus of our efforts and our energies also needs to be on the 7,000. Don't let the 70,000 or the 700,000 or whatever there was in Israel at that time, don't let them rob you of your energies and desire and willingness to help save the remnant. Don't let it happen. It happened in Elijah's case and is recorded so that we will see that's what we need to avoid. Even when we hear of Jezebel's influences making inroads, don't let that rob your faith, love, and hope when it comes to serving and helping save the remnant, especially the wonderful young people and children that we have with us this week. Elijah arrives at Horeb and he needs to change his thinking about the need for God to destroy the nation. And to dramatize the new thinking, God sends Elijah his own personal amazing miracle. And it comes in four acts. You see, what God is trying to emphasize for Elijah when he's up there on the mountain is, Elijah, you need to change your thinking. You need to change your focus. Elijah had stood on Mount Carmel and challenged the people to change their thinking and change their ways. And God now will appeal to Elijah to do that very thing, challenging him to change his thinking and his ways. So verses 11 and 12 in chapter 19 are in response to what Paul records in Romans 11, verses 2 to 4, when Elijah had gone to Horeb to intercede against the people. And if you thought that fireball from Carmel was impressive, these three miracles, followed by the still small voice, Carmel pales by comparison. First comes the wind, likely a hurricane, with full gale force. Elijah quickly recedes into the cave, the record says, because of the power of the wind. It was so strong, it would have blown him right off the mountain. And he recedes into the cave, but God was not in the wind. God's voice did not come forth from the wind. Next comes the earthquake, when Elijah is deep inside the cave, thinking he's now safe. He doesn't know what's going to happen next. We do, because we've read the story so many times. But put yourself with Elijah. You know, you're now back inside the cave. You're protected from the wind. It's howling out there, but you're protected from it. And then it goes away. And then the ground begins to shake and shake. Where are you going to go now when you're up in a mountain inside of a cave? But God's voice was not in the earthquake. Next comes the fire. How big a fireball did God need in Mount Carmel to consume an altar made of 12 stones with wood and a bullock on top? 10 feet in diameter, 12 feet in diameter, 20 feet in diameter? It would be unlike God to send something that was 300 feet in diameter if all he needed was 15 feet. How big of a fireball do you need on the side of a mountain to make an impression? And there's likely nothing on the mountain to burn. So this will simply be a divinely sent fireball that is burning of itself, roaring up the mountain. But God's voice was not in the fireball. And Elijah is deeply embedded in the cave, and he hears a voice, a still small voice. So much of a whisper is what the Hebrew seems to indicate, a gentle whisper, that he actually has to put on his mantle across his face and then come out to the front of the cave to hear it, because it's that thin of a voice, that whisper that he hears. What are you doing here at Horeb, Elijah? To which he responds in defense of his actions and his motives. And what we find is the still small voice asks penetrating questions that are intended to cause us to re-examine our actions and our motives and compare them to God's principles. That's what the still small voice was doing in the case of Elijah. Only in his case, it's a literal voice that was speaking to him. For us, we don't hear the literal voice of God when we open his word. But it is the same still small voice asking the same penetrating questions, challenging us to examine our motives. Challenging us to make sure our will lines up with God's will. It enters our mind like a gentle whisper. Not like a hurricane, not like an earthquake, not like a raging fire. That's why God wasn't in the wind and the earthquake and the fire. But he's in the still small voice. Because as he's teaching Elijah at Mount Horeb, this is my real power to save men and women. The still small voice that enters their mind, that asks penetrating questions, that challenges the direction of their life, that teaches them principles by which they live, so that the decisions they will make are made in their mind. The miracles, the fireballs, the earthquakes. There is no power in them to save. They can arrest sin's hold momentarily. They can cause us to pause where we're going. But fireballs and earthquakes and wind don't transform character. God needs a power at work in our life to transform character. Which is why in Romans 1:16 we read that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Words is the power of God unto salvation to those who believe the words. 1 Corinthians 1:18, the preaching of the cross, words. Foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God unto salvation. Foolish to think a man died on a cross and somehow that is bound up in my salvation and I should have anything to do with that, is how the world looks at it. But God says, you get the teachings of the man on the cross into your heart and understand what it means to crucify the flesh and why that's important. And why you need to take on that man's name and take on his affections and take on his teachings. And you align your life with that man. Now there's power in that that God can use to save us. That's the lesson that Elijah is learning at Mount Horeb. The power of God is greater than the power of sin. And we've been showing that to the kids this week. That's why it's important that we learn these things. Because we get these lessons into our hearts and minds. And it can't just live up here. At some point, all those good lessons that we're learning, they have to live down here in our hearts, or it changes the way we live. But what Elijah learned at Horeb is that will become a power in a person's life that is greater than the power of Jezebel. I'm not sure he believed it when he got to Horeb, but we know for certain that he did when he left. It can transform characters. It can make young people and older people strong for God. It can give them spiritual courage to stand up against evil in the world. It's not a magical process. It's not a magical power. It doesn't happen automatically, and it doesn't happen with everyone. Only the ones who hear the word and commit it in their life. And that is why we have workbooks before we come to kids' camp. Because that starts the process of getting the word of God into the heads of the kids. So at some point then, once it's in the heads, they can connect it with the lessons. And it can get into their heart. So that when they come then for a week and talk about these things, and they see older uncles and aunts who have committed themselves in that direction, and they see Elijah, how he committed himself, and the widow of Zarephath, and Obadiah, and then Elisha, and they see this is really a power. They had no idea when they opened those workbooks, when they came in the mail or they were delivered to them, that this had to do with the power of God unto salvation. It was just a list of a bunch of questions. They had the answer before they could go to kids' camp. But that's where the process starts. And it's a wonderful process. And brothers and sisters, we need to be able to teach them how to unlock this power, how to unleash this power, so that they can see this book we call the Bible is not like a math textbook. It's not like a history book or a biology book. You don't learn these things and take a test and forget them. This is a power that is introduced in our life that is greater than the power of all of those temptations and all of those influences that incite our lusts. It doesn't mean that we won't sin, but even when we sin, there is power from this book because it tells us what we need to do to get back right with God. And we would suggest there are four steps to teaching our children and our young people how to unleash the power of the still small voice in their life. And it's something we've been doing all week. We haven't talked about it in these terms. So this shouldn't be new. But it starts with a commitment on the part of the individual. They are committed to doing what's right. They can see the good and they can see the evil. And they make a commitment to choose the good, to live the right life, to love righteousness, and to hate the evil. Secondly, it requires a respect for the Bible. That it is true and it does have power. Don't ask me how, they may say. I'm not quite sure how this book has power, but all the adults seem to say it has, so it must. But they respect the scriptures, that it alone can teach us how to do the right that we have committed to. So that the third step is then learn its teachings, not just up here, but to learn them down here in our hearts so that we will live those teachings. So we read it and study it and we learn its stories and its lessons and its principles. And we take readings quizzes that remind us of what we know and what we've forgotten already. It's all good because it's reinforcing that third step. That's the beauty of Kids Camp, because it reinforces. It is a week devoted to step two and three. Most all of us come, I think all of us are here because of step two and respecting the Bible, and then it's a week spent around learning the teachings. But the power is unleashed, not in step one, two, or three. The power is unleashed when we learn to live what I learned. That's when the power is made available, when we apply the lessons and the principles. We couple this with prayer and godly friends who are also interested in having the same power unleashed in our life, in their life, sorry. And it needs to be coupled with avoiding discouragement, because we will fail. And as powerful as the word is, because of our nature and because of who we are, weak creatures, We will fail, but we can't let the failing lead to discouragement. We need to eliminate the ungodly influences, whether they be people or activities. And then we need to commit to continuing to learn the Bible. All of these things help increase the power. But I would encourage you, plead with you sometime today or tomorrow. Now, we haven't covered this slide yet with the teens, but it's all right. Cover it anyways. So when I cover it tomorrow, then they can hear it the second time. Take the time this week with your own children, who are those three, four, or five campers that you have been given responsibility to, and talk to them about this principle, how there is actually power in the Bible to change how we live, to change how we walk. They'll never hear this at school, unless they go to CHC. But this is something that our children need to learn, our young people need to learn. And we can talk about it as parents, not just we, in our homes, so that they can begin to learn how to tap into that power, and the power can be unleashed in their life. We'll just conclude with the wonder and the wisdom of the God we worship. And it has to do with how he was working in the life of Elijah. God takes the outcome of Carmel, which had a devastating impact on Elijah. Devastating impact. It leaves him so depressed he wants to die. And God uses Carmel to teach Elijah about the power that can save. And Elijah is converted and is turned back to God as a result of his journey to Horeb and to God's thinking. Remember how at Carmel he prayed that the hearts of the people would be turned back to God? When Elijah gets to Horeb, his heart needs to be turned back to God. And God is able to do that at Horeb. And you ask Elijah, what was it that caused your heart to be turned back to God when you were so depressed leaving Jezreel, and then you were so convinced the people should be destroyed? And Elijah would be the first person to tell us, by firsthand experience, that what changed me, what converted me, was the power of the still, small voice. So he had firsthand experience in how God asking penetrating questions, not from his word, but in this case from his voice, caused Elijah to change his outlook. Yes, those who were practicing the evil would be dealt with. And he gives them a prophecy and says, the ones Hazael doesn't get, Jehu will get. And the ones Jehu doesn't get, Elisha will get. I'll take care of those. But Elijah, that's not my focus. My focus is on saving the 7,000. That's what your focus needs to be. And Elijah heard that and responded to it, so that the power of the still small voice converted Elijah from one who sought the nation's destruction to the wonderment that God will take this same man, as Brother David has been covering in his classes, who prayed for Israel's destruction, and God will take this same man and use him to help save the people at the second coming of Christ. And the power that Elijah will use will not be wind, earthquake, and fire. It will be the power of the still small voice to turn the hearts of the people back to God. So that when John the Baptist came, and it says he came in the power and the spirit and power of Elijah, this was Elijah after Mount Horeb. This was Elijah who had learned what the real power of God to save is. And that's why John the Baptist used no miracle. What he did was he went around Israel as a voice crying in the wilderness. And that voice was a divine message that entered into people's minds and which asked penetrating questions designed to expose their sin, in order to change their walk, in order to encourage them to transform their character. That's the lesson that Elijah learned at Horeb. And it was a wonderful lesson to learn, and a vital lesson to learn, because when he gets home from Horeb, his public ministry will now begin. And he is now ready to minister to the nation with the power of the still small voice.